I'm Marty Moscoe. Welcome to Radio Times. President Obama was interviewed on 60 Minutes last night about the crisis in Syria and U.S. presidential politics. Steve Croft asked him about a training program the administration suspended last week because only a few Syrian rebels were battle-ready after spending hundreds of millions of dollars.
One of the challenges that I've had throughout this heartbreaking situation inside of Syria is that you'll have people insist that, you know, all you have to do is send in a few truckloads full of arms and people are ready to fight. Then when you start a train and equip program and it doesn't work, then people say, well, why didn't it work? Or if it had just started 3 months earlier, it would have worked.
But you said yourself you never believed in this.
Well, but Steve, what I have also said is that surprisingly enough, it turns out that in a situation that is as volatile with as many players as there are inside of Syria, there aren't any silver bullets. And this is precisely why I've been very clear that America's priorities has to be, number one, keeping the American people safe. Number two, we are prepared to work both diplomatically and, where we can, support moderate opposition that can help convince the Russians and the Iranians to put pressure on Assad for a transition, but that what we are not going to do is to try to reinsert ourselves in a military campaign inside of Syria.
As to whether the U.S. was in retreat because Russia was inserting itself in the Middle East to protect Syrian President Assad, President Obama replied that Putin's military action could backfire.
When I came into office, Ukraine was governed by a corrupt ruler who was a stooge of Mr. Putin. Syria was Russia's only ally in the region. And today, rather than being able to count on their support and maintain the base they had in Syria, which they've had for a long time, Mr. Putin now is devoting his own troops, his own military, just to barely hold together by a thread his sole ally.
He's challenging your leadership, Mr. President.
Steve, I got to tell you, if you think that running your economy into the ground and having to send troops in order to prop up your only ally is leadership, then we've got a different definition of leadership.
In this hour of Radio Times, we're looking at why Russia stepped into the Syrian conflict, what it means for the U.S. and the region, and we have two guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studio. Samer Aboud is Associate Professor of International Studies at Arcadia University, also a non-resident senior fellow at the Center for Syrian Studies at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland, also the author of a forthcoming book about the Syrian conflict entitled Simply Syria. Samer Aboud, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Also with us is Mitchell Orenstein, professor of Central and Eastern European politics in the Slavic Department at the University of Pennsylvania. He's also a senior fellow at the Foreign Policy Research Institute, a frequent contributor to the journal Foreign Affairs. And Mitchell Orenstein, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Great. Thanks for being here.
You're very welcome. Samer, let me begin with you. And even as the president was talking last night about U.S. policy and all the moving parts, as he described it, in Syria and the region, I was thinking about the humanitarian crisis and the images that we've seen of, you know, people in desperation leaving this country, Syria, to try to find a better life somewhere else out in the world. Are we witnessing the destruction of a country?
Absolutely. We're now at the point where more than half of Syrians are either dead or displaced. The other half who are living are living in quite terrible conditions. And I can tell you that with some certainty that a majority of them would like to leave, if not for the fact that many of the options for them, whether it's the Mediterranean, possible death in the Mediterranean, or life in Turkey, Jordan, and Lebanon, which is becoming increasingly difficult because the laws are becoming more restrictive, not only on residency, but on the mobility and the ability of Syrians to work. So everywhere that Syrians look, they're facing either a potential death, displacement, or a life of even more uncertainty in a neighboring country. And I think that what we've seen in 2015 is an acceleration of the violence, which means that the humanitarian crisis now is getting worse and worse.
A people without a country, essentially, is what you're describing.
Absolutely. There's no real sense of safety, I think, or security. There's an objective fear that runs throughout, I think, every Syrian community in every geographic area. And that extends, of course, into the diaspora now, where people are even fearing for their lives, whether in Europe or Turkey or in Lebanon.
And are we, I do want to get to you, Mitchell, but are we talking about a civil war? Is that what's going on in Syria, you see it?
I think a civil war is certainly happening, but I think we're at the point now with Russia that I believe it's the 13th country to have bombed Syria, if we include the 10 countries in the U.S.-led coalition. The crisis is extending deep into Europe in terms of the refugee crisis, so perhaps the civil war doesn't quite capture what we're actually talking about. We do have intervention into the country. We have governments such as Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Turkey, whose intelligence apparatus are working often in contradiction to each other, as well as private funding. And so it's very complicated. And so if our definition of a civil war is one side fighting another for capture of the state, I don't think it quite captures what we're witnessing here today in Syria.
Mitchell, let me turn to you and help us understand why Vladimir Putin, the president of Russia, why he, quote unquote, inserted himself in this conflict. How does he see what's going on in Syria, as you understand it?
Well, I think there's many reasons that he has, many interests that Russia has in Syria. One is that it has a naval base in Syria. It's had for a long time. Second, Syria has been a client state of Russia, in essence, and its primary partner in the Middle East. It also was trying to distract attention from its rather debilitating conflict it had gotten into in Ukraine and the very negative publicity and negative attitudes that came out towards Russia about that conflict. So it was trying to change the page and look like it was taking leadership in world affairs. It wants to prove that Putin wants to prove that he's at the first table of international politics, that it's important to negotiate with Russia and to take their interests into account in all these circumstances. But I think one of the issues that simply hasn't been discussed that does need to be mentioned is natural gas.
Yeah.
Syria is or was trying to become a crossroads for natural gas pipelines coming out of the Middle East, particularly out of Qatar and out of Iran. And it instead of becoming a crossroads, it became a battleground for two competing pipeline projects, one running through Iran and the other trying to bring Qatari gas up through Saudi Arabia and Turkey via Syria. So to some extent, Putin was also trying to kill the Qatari pipeline. And I believe this had a major impact on Russia's interests as far as it's a major exporter of gas to Europe, where these pipelines were also headed.
Do you think it also, in a sense, involves the United States? We're now an exporter of natural gas. I mean, we're now a natural gas power, a player in the world as well. Is that sort of a part of this conflict, this background between these two leaders?
I think there's a conspiracy of silence about the gas issue and the energy issues, because no country wants to see itself as taking part in any way in creating the type of devastation that was just talked about in Syria for something as economic and base as gas or energy resources or effectively money. But in fact, that is a core interest for a lot of countries. From the U.S. point of view, we have an interest in having gas come out cheaply out of the Middle East. We would like probably to see both of these pipelines completed, but primarily the one that's associated with our ally Qatar rather than Iran. But we're willing to also do business with Iran now. The issue is that Russia doesn't want to see the gas come out cheaply from the Middle East. It wants to see it not come out at all, or if it does come out via its ally, Iran.
Well, I mean, so if I'm just spinning out a scenario here. So if Syria becomes a failed state, it will be sort of unable to be a energy player and thereby empowers Russia in its control over this resource?
Yeah, one could imagine that it would play better into Russia's interest than to ours to have Syria be a failed state. It's very hard to imagine how you can build pipelines in a failed state.
Exactly.
Maybe it's possible if you concoct a kind of alliance or some sort of agreement. But I think a lot depends on a political agreement. I agree with Samer here that this is really – what really needs to happen is a political solution to get people together, talk about an issue and work out an arrangement. This arrangement, in my view, will not put Syria back together.
Mm-hmm.
Syria is probably not a state now and will not be a state, in my opinion, for a very long time, maybe forever. And so I think where things would head likely in a negotiation would be towards some sort of – you can't say it politely, but sort of partition in essentially some sort of partition or separation of Syria into composite parts and agreements about what goes through where and who's in control in what area. And then that's exactly what mm-hmm. is very problematic. I think when Putin says that he wants to create a political solution, or he's trying to use military to create a political solution, I think that's what he's talking about. He's talking about, let's all get the great powers together, we'll hash this out and work out our arrangements. And the problem is that U.S. and Russia have completely opposed interests in Syria, and that
and policies, it seems, as well. I mean, what the president, Samer, seemed to be saying last night, which is this stuff. I mean, it takes time to try to. I mean, we're also talking about fighting ISIS as well, the problems of the Syrian presidency and government. But this takes time. It takes people on the ground that are willing to fight for some kind of a country for themselves.
Absolutely. We now in Syria, I think for me, one of the bigger problems is that there are more than 1,000 militias in Syria right now. And we have what I refer to and what I think about as kind of networks of violence. So the assumption that there are moderate rebels who remain moderate or Islamist rebels that remain Islamist and that the country can be neatly divided into kind of ISIS territories or Kurdish territories betrays the complexity of how violence is occurring in the country. So what we see, for example, is in the Kurdish areas, the Kurdish forces are clearly trying to create contiguous territory in the north, from the northeast up until kind of north of Aleppo into mm-hmm. Kobani, just a bit west of Kobani. But what's happened is that the Kurds will often wait until ISIS takes over a territory and then go in and fight ISIS and remove them. So even the geography of the conflict is constantly changing. And then if we look at, for example, the Army of Conquest, which has been in the news now, which is one of these new fronts, is a conglomeration of brigades that a year ago were fighting each other. Some of them would have been fighting each other. So the players on the ground, I would agree that it's very difficult to kind of pinpoint mm-hmm. Who they are, who's fighting who. But I think that for the most part, the administration and Europe in general have hid behind this cloak of looking for moderate rebels. We don't really have a definition of what a moderate rebel is. And we do know that that oftentimes rebels, because of the nature of the conflict, will have to cooperate with one another. So you have, for example, Free Syrian Army fighters cooperating in the south with Nusra fighters, but fighting them in Halab and Idlib.
We have to take a very short break. We'll pick up on that conversation, talking with Samer Abood and Mitchell Orenstein about the crisis in Syria. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at radiotimes@whyy.org. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, talking with Mitchell Orenstein. He's a professor of Central and Eastern European Politics at the University of Pennsylvania in the Slavic Department, also a senior fellow at the Foreign Policy Research Institute here in Philadelphia. Samer Abood, associate professor of international studies at Arcadia University, a non-resident senior fellow at the Center for Assyrian Studies at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland. And he's got a book coming out in just a week or two titled Syria, the topic for our conversation in this hour of the show. We have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Mitchell, let me go back to you and actually ask you on the air something we were talking about before the show began, which is, do you think that Russian President Vladimir Putin essentially pulled a fast one on the U.S. and its allies, talking about coming in and fighting ISIS? But what we have found in the last week or so is what the Russian military has been targeting are some of these rebels that Samer was talking about.
Absolutely. Yes, I... I think he did pull a fast one. I think what's really been remarkable in all the conflicts that we have with Russia is just how little we know about Putin's intentions and how little the government appears to know about Putin's intentions, how little they can read what he's trying to do, and how close to the chest he keeps his cards. It's fascinating. In
Why
an era,
don't we know that? I mean, he's been a player for so many years now.
I suspect because we've relied on tapping every single European leader's cell phone, but we don't have his tapped. And we don't also have the human intelligence to be able to really read what's going on with him. So he's very adept at disinformation. You have to always remember he's a KGB colonel. That's how he was brought up. He plays that all the time. I see info ops all the time that he plays out against the European leaders, against the American leaders. And this was clearly one of them where you just fool them and make them look silly. Now, it has a strategic purpose. I think the administration rebalanced itself within a few days and now is making sense again. But the fact that they were caught off balance for even a few days really was a strategic victory to some extent, although Obama denied it. It was a strategic victory for him because he's trying to show to the world that the U.S. is not in charge in the Middle East and the U.S. doesn't know what it's doing. And so when he makes them look silly, then that's exactly what people think.
Well, even going back to what President Obama was saying last night, I mean, he said this before, which is he does not want boots on the ground. It's not like we're not bombing parts of Syria, as other countries are, but he is reluctant to go perhaps that next step that Putin doesn't feel reluctant about.
Yes, that's right. I mean, I think there's this deeper problem that all throughout on the Syria conflict, the U.S. has been reluctant to get very involved. Right. And I think largely, we obviously underestimated how bad the situation was going to get. I mean, I don't think anybody could have imagined how bad this was going to get. But I think, and the administration also had been burnt by its intervention in Libya, which also didn't work out that great. So, from the administration's point of view, I understand they feel like, well, whatever we do, it's going to be a disaster.
Right.
This is just a tumultuous, troubled time in the Middle East. If we're on the side of Mubarak, we're in bad shape. If we're not on his side, we're in bad shape. I mean, whoever you choose, it's not a great situation. So the president will get blamed for that. So there is that. On the other hand, with Syria, at the very least, the United States could be exercising leadership and pulling together countries for a political solution for this conflict, rather than. Talking about it in a way that doesn't make sense to people, saying things on different sides of the issue and not following through. So it just it doesn't give a high perception of U.S. leadership in the Middle East, and I think that's something that a lot of people are looking for.
Right. Well, speaking of strong leaders, some are thinking about President Assad, and there's this argument, do you keep him in power at least temporarily, hoping to stabilize the region, or do you get rid of him because he's used barrel bombs against his own people and, is clearly a problem within his own country?
Absolutely. I think it was when I was watching the kind of dueling speeches between Putin and Obama at the UN General Assembly and then the aftermath of that where there was this very public debate about should we keep him or should we not. And I thought that it was a bit silly, to be honest, because the conflict is beyond the presidency of Syria at this point.
You're saying it almost doesn't matter?
It doesn't matter.
That he's there or not?
Absolutely not. The drivers of the conflict now are no longer kind of control of the state or an attempt to control the state or to initiate even a political transition process, because the people who have weapons on the ground, the authorities on the ground are not committed to a political transition process, and we certainly don't have any guarantees that they would. The only bodies in the quote-unquote opposition or in the rebel movement that are committed to a political transition process are those that are weakest on the ground.
Right.
And so we're not sure where obviously ISIS is out of the equation of a political transition process, but where do the Kurds stand in terms of the PYD, who are establishing, as the conflict goes on, the Rojava administration, which is either, in the best case scenario for them, setting up statehood, and potentially in the worst case scenario, some sort of decentralized agreement with an emasculated state, whether that is the outcome in the post-conflict phase or not. So the the people who on the ground, the groups on the ground that have the ability to affect the course of the conflict are not committed to a political transition process. And so you could have one that includes Assad or doesn't include Assad. And I do not believe, for at this point, that even the groups that are fighting on the side of the regime, quote-unquote, are committed to his survival. The National Defense Forces, for example, which now outnumber the National Army, which is basically a militia, a Syrian militia that is institutionalized and has a relationship to the state but operates independently of the state. We know that there have been conflicts between the leaders of the National Defense Forces and the intelligence apparatus. This is an alternative authority on the ground. It is an alternative power. And we don't know whether its leadership or the extent to which its leadership is committed to Assad, let alone whether it would support a political transition.
Let me go back to you, Mitchell. Do you worry, or should we be worried, that there will be some kind of either conflict between the U.S. and Russia directly involving Syria, or perhaps they will bomb some kind of site where the U.S. has a presence, or there will be a mid-air collision between airplanes? I'm just trying to think out various scenarios. But here we are, essentially fighting over the same country, but with different goals in mind.
Yeah, I mean, in answer to your question, I think we already are in a direct conflict with Russia in Syria and have been. And it raises a further question I think that really we need to put on the table, which is just how we're talking about this conflict.
Right.
It seems we've heard here that, you know, just calling the term moderate rebels. I think what Obama was saying last night was that there isn't such a thing as moderate rebels. We couldn't find them. So we're talking about the conflict in language that is absolutely unrealistic. We're not talking about the natural gas issue. We're not really talking about who we're in conflict with. Half the time we say we're in partnership with the Russians when, in fact, we're fighting them on the ground. So I think
let's get our language right.
Yes, and vis-a-vis a political solution, I haven't heard anybody in the media saying what you said, Samer, about what a political solution is going to look like to the conflict. So I think before the key thing that needs to happen at this point in terms of the media and in terms of the government, the administration in the U.S., is we have to start talking about the Syria conflict in a language that is realistic. And that simply has not happened. People have interests in trying to cover up what we're trying to do or make this sound like a fight against ISIS or, you know, because everybody hates terrorism. I can see how that's easy to sell. But it's just not accurate. And so what needs to happen is we need to talk about what is Syria going to look like? How that's going to be arranged? What our interests are in Syria? What Russia's interests are, and how we're fighting them? I mean, I think we are. They're bombing the people who we are supplying, and we're shooting with our weapons, or our people are shooting with our weapons, their tanks. I mean, it's a conflict, and nobody wants it to get completely out of hand. Absolutely, I don't think Russia or the U.S. wants to do that. This is a question of a test of wills and seeing who's going to stare down the other first.
Well, and you know, it's clear that Putin and Obama don't really like each other very much. I don't know in international affairs, Mitchell, if that means anything. I mean, oftentimes people that oppose each other have to negotiate together, even if they don't like each other. But it's pretty clear that Obama looked in his eyes and he didn't see what President Bush saw.
Yeah, that's a great observation. I think, Putin is very pragmatic at some level, right? So he's doing this for pragmatic reasons. You know, we just negotiated the Iran deal with the Russians. It's interesting that throughout all the conflicts and all the problems that we've had with Russia, both Russia and the U.S. administration felt that they had a common interest in dealing with Iran. I think that common interest is very simply stated. Neither side wanted to have Iran have nuclear weapons.
Right.
And the Russians didn't want it, and the U.S. didn't want it. The Russians are allied with Iran, but they still didn't want them to have nuclear weapons for understandable reasons. They want to have nuclear weapons. So yes, I don't think they like each other. I don't think it necessarily matters very much either.
Right.
I think that what is damaging is when Kerry and Lavrov say they like each other or think they like each other or think they're being honest to each other or think they're getting on the phone and getting correct information from one another when they're not. But no, I think negotiations, of course, in international affairs can go on regardless of how badly one dislikes one, the other side.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Mitchell Orenstein from the University of Pennsylvania, Samer Aboud from Arcadia University. We are talking about Syria, Russia's involvement in the Syrian conflict, President Obama's interview last night on 60 Minutes, where he talked in some detail about Syria, a rather interesting, I thought contentious, but illuminating interview that he did with Steve Croft. You can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. So some are just looking ahead and not to do what Mitchell told us not to do, which is to put some kind of rosy scenario, put the good guys over here and the bad guys over there. How do you see this ending? I mean, where is this going?
That's a very good question that I think about every day and don't have a solid answer to. But in the spirit of what Mitchell encouraged us to do and to think about and talk about the conflict in a different way, I'd like to suggest that we reorient how we think about the role of Russia and the U.S. in terms of a political transition, and maybe think about the role that Iran and Turkey are playing in terms of, and even God forbid, the United Nations, and the role that de Mistura is playing as the special envoy, and what de Mistura has done, and is contra what Annan and Brahimi did before him, was rather than trying to negotiate a grand solution, you know, that includes the United States and Russia and everybody, which is what essentially the Russians and the Americans are trying to do now. What he tried to do is work from the position of fostering local truces and freezes, and what would typically happen is that different rebel groups would come together, because there aren't regime and rebel groups, there are multiple groups, and they would come together and spend days and sometimes weeks negotiating very specific agreements over freezes. But what would happen is that they would break down almost immediately. But recently in Idlib, after the Army of Conquest took over Idlib, there was an Iranian and Turkish brokered agreement between the regime. And one of the big points of the agreement is that the regime agreed to a no-fly zone, agreed not to fly and drop barrel bombs over the areas, which was a really big achievement for the rebels, because this is the main form of terror that people are experiencing in these areas. The regime broke the ceasefire once, not I think it was through just fighting, not with barrel bombs, but it was broken once. But today it sticks. It still sticks, because the Iranian leadership, which negotiated the agreement, by the way, these agreements aren't negotiated by Syrians on the ground. They're negotiated by the Revolutionary Guard officials who are there, in conjunction with the Turkish intelligence, and they were able to put enough pressure on the different rebel groups in order to honor the ceasefire, and that at the very least, gives the people some reprieve from the terror of these barrel bombs, and allows for the movement of goods and food and things that people need for their daily lives. That's at the very least. So perhaps that's an alternative way of thinking about how the conflict may get to the point where the groups are so fatigued that we can talk with some certainty about the feasibility of a political transition process, because at this point, whether Assad goes or stays is irrelevant. It's ultimately the rebel groups on the ground that are going to determine the feasibility of a political process.
Well, let me get some callers in the conversation. Looks like we have Dan from Winmore joining us on Radio Times. Dan, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I've been surprised that Russia did not get into this conflict earlier, sort of under the diplomatic theory of strange bedfellows, essentially a coalition with the U.S. and other countries, not necessarily to fight Assad and prop him up, but to actually go after the ISIS forces. As Marty said, you know, was this a bait and switch? Does ISIS present a threat to Russia through Chechnya and any sort of disruption they may do there, since Chechen rebels are Muslim?
Dan, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. I'm tossing it to Mitchell Orenstein.
Well, yes, that's very perceptive. Russia has a big issue, as you know, with terrorism. In fact, Russia is much more exposed to terrorism than any Western country. It's the 10th most likely country in the world to be attacked by terrorists. And it has a big terrorist population of its own who are fighting in Syria. So Russia definitely has that concern. Anytime there's disruption, anytime there's a conflict like that, you have fighters who are being trained and exported elsewhere. But I still don't – I don't think that's its number one interest in Syria. It has a very deep connection with the Assad regime going back many decades, very intertwined. As I mentioned, they have gas relationships, resource relationships, which are their number one business. They have a base down there. Summer mentioned Turkey. Fighting in Syria allows Russia to put pressure on Turkey, which is, by the way, the number two purchaser of Russian gas. And to prevent Turkey from having its own geopolitical control in the Middle East, which it's been trying to assert for a number of years to frustrate those ambitions. So the terrorist issue is certainly something of great concern to Russia, but I would place it maybe four or five or six down their list of priorities.
Dan, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Almost a minute before we have our second break, Mitchell, how about the sanctions? Have they hurt the Russian economy and even its natural gas ambitions?
Yes, absolutely. You mean the European sanctions against Russia vis-a-vis the Ukraine crisis?
Yes.
Absolutely. I mean, it's hard to measure because at the same time the oil prices collapsed around the same time that sanctions came on. Now, some people say, well, that means that it's really just they're suffering from the price of oil. My perspective is, well, if the sanctions hadn't been there, maybe the oil price wouldn't have declined as much. There's obviously some interaction going on there because that disrupted the ability of Russia, to act, or it's changed the market in certain ways. There's a lot of factors in the oil market, of course. But yes, I mean, I think Russia's economy is in fact sinking. So I think Obama did have a point last night when he said that Russia's acting out of weakness. The way I see it is Russia is in a weakened situation. The sanctions have hurt its economy. It's in recession right now. It cannot survive over the long term with $40 a barrel oil. And Russia needs to elevate the price of oil. It needs to elevate the price of its main exports, and that's why it's so concerned with controlling the routes of gas into Europe.
Well, we're going to take another short break, get back to our conversation. I see a bunch of folks want to join us. We like that. Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. Talking with Mitchell Orenstein and Samer Aboud about the crisis in Syria, all the various players. As Samer said, there's something like 1,000 rebel groups operating on the ground in Syria. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, talking both on and off the air about the crisis in Syria. Our guests are Samer Aboud, Associate Professor of International Studies at Arcadia University, author of a forthcoming book entitled Syria, Mitchell Orenstein, Professor of Central and Eastern European Politics at the University of Pennsylvania, also a Senior Fellow at the Foreign Policy Research Institute. And again, you can join the conversation calling us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. Summer, let me just quickly go back to you, and then we'll get some more callers in on the conversation. If you could advise Obama, I realize extremely unfair question, but nonetheless, you've been thinking about this a lot. I mean, what should the U.S. do? In many ways, the Obama, as Mitchell was saying, has a sort of a mixed message, I think, that it's sending about Syria, but what could clean that up? What would be a more effective policy?
I think the key problem is commitment. So the administration has made political promises, has made very clear policy declarations. They want Assad to go. He shouldn't be part of the transition. And then Kerry kind of sometimes contradicts it. So the first thing is that we need clarity in terms of the U.S. policy. The second is a commitment to those policies. So Obama and our, in the clip that we heard at the very beginning, referenced the catastrophe, the humanitarian catastrophe. But we know that, by all accounts, the administration is not really doing anything to address that catastrophe. And there are very simple things that we could do. And it doesn't involve dealing with governments necessarily, but through groups and organizations that are on the ground in the borderlands and also inside of Syria that can help alleviate some of the pressure that is being placed on populations there. So
the human suffering you're talking about.
We say that we're really distraught and saddened by this, but we don't do anything about it. We say that we want Assad to go, but we don't really devote the resources to the Geneva process, which is what the Americans had committed to in terms of a political transition. We say that we want to get rid of ISIS, so we bomb a few areas around Raqqa, but we don't have a no-fly zone. And so there really isn't a lot of clarity around the policy decisions that are being taken and how they're being implemented. I think the administration at some point will have to answer as to why it did not implement a no-fly zone in Syria. There are thousands and thousands of barrel bombs that are being dropped on populations in the north. And this is a humanitarian issue. This isn't a rebels or regime issue. That this is something, a demand of the opposition, both internal and external, and also a demand of the Free Syrian Army, which I certainly have my own problems and issues with
the Free Syrian Army,
but certainly this would not have jeopardized U.S. interests in terms of weapons falling into Al Qaeda's hands or ISIS hands or anything like that. And so we were saying one thing and doing another. And I think that there has to be clarity and commitment, and especially on the humanitarian issue.
Let me get some more callers in on the conversation. It looks like we have Terrence from Cherry Hill joining us on Radio Times. Hi, Terrence. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you very much for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I've been following this Middle East situation very carefully, and what I find is both your guests have missed in this equation is the idea of the United States wanted to make regime changes. We saw that in Iraq. The carnage that the country is undergoing is immense. We saw that in Libya. Now we are seeing that in Syria. In Syria was a local conflict, and the United States intervened and tried to supply arms to the side that they thought they were going to support. But ultimately, all those individuals defected to ISIS, and that's how ISIS have all these sophisticated weapons. Because of the United States.
Well, you know, Terrence, let me just stop you there only because we had a lot of people in on the line, and what I hear him saying, I don't know, I might put this back to you, which is that this was an internal conflict in Syria, and the U.S. intervened, and voila. Here's the problem that we have.
Yeah. Well, we should even go further back and remember that this was an uprising against socioeconomic deterioration. That's what this started as. It didn't start as a sectarian conflict. ISIS didn't exist. Nusra didn't exist. FSA didn't exist. None of these things existed when people began their protests in early 2011. This morphed into an armed conflict because of the repression of the regime. So the regime's policy was basically to shoot at people as the solution to everything. As the conflict became militarized, it became more regionalized because regional powers were funneling money. And then, as we know, around 2012, 2013, this is when it becomes really internationalized, when there are questions around the Geneva process, the chemical weapons issues, things like this, where the international powers are asked and play a bigger role in the conflict. So it's morphed considerably from what it was at the beginning.
Go ahead,
Mitchell. Can I jump in here? So I hear something slightly different in the caller's question, which is there's a very common refrain in particularly the Russian media and to some extent critiques about U.S. policy that the U.S. is overly committed to a policy of regime change. And I would just say that certainly the U.S. Tends to support democratic opposition to authoritarian regimes. That is no secret. But I think that this is a very simplistic way of looking at the conflict, a very complex conflict. First of all, I don't think the United States could have paid anybody enough to go out and protest the Assad regime. This was absolutely a domestic conflict, as Samir said, a domestic opposition. People had really had enough of socioeconomic problems. And then I think the other thing that's missed by the caller is all the other countries that are involved.
Right.
In my view, it wasn't really the U.S. actually who began supporting rebels. It was more Qatar and some of our allies in the Middle East. So it's too simplistic an approach. It's really a propaganda line that is pitched by the Putin administration that just isn't inaccurate, and it's just intended to sort of blame everything on the U.S., which in the very complex situation like this, I can't see.
Let me get – looks like Bruce from Rose Valley to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Bruce. Go ahead. You're on the air. Go ahead, Bruce.
Yes. I'm sorry. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
So one of your guests earlier mentioned that we're effectively watching a failed state occur. And my question has to do with chemical and biological weapons and the risk of those falling into the hands of people that we wouldn't want them to fall into. You know, what's the assessment of risk along those lines?
Yeah, and that's another worrisome issue. Samer, can you take that?
My understanding is that there are still chemical weapons being used in Syria, but they're not of the kind that would pose this is awful to say and to think, but they're right now they're only a threat to Syrians. There's things like chlorine being dropped through barrel bombs. There's some evidence of ISIS getting their hands on short-range missiles and using chemical weapons for those. I don't think that they're a global threat in the way that they might have been before the agreement to destroy most of the stockpiles. But there's also evidence coming out now that not all of those stockpiles were created. So it's certainly a threat, but I don't think that it's as big as a threat as it was prior to 2013.
Bruce, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let me go back to you, Mitchell, and I realize you were certainly not a stand-in for President Putin, but from his perspective, how does he – I mean, obviously Russia has involved itself in this conflict in Syria. How do you think he sees it ending, obviously in Russia's favor?
That's a great question. I mean, I think that he sees it – I think his ideal ending would be that the U.S. accedes to an Iran-Iraq-Syria pipeline. And an agreement to more or less allow an alliance of Russia and Iran to manage many of the problems of the Middle East. And I think, frankly, I've heard very troubling words out of the administration, people I know who are close to the administration, really arguing for that and saying, look, you know, the Middle East is too much trouble. We have to spend too much money. We have to be, on our guard all the time. Let's just let the Russians and the Iranians sort this out. And if people in the administration are thinking that, I think that's completely stupid. I mean, just absolutely, you know, a harebrained idea. Because the problem
well, – what I heard, I mean, and I don't have any special knowledge, which is try to let them sort it out and it's going to blow up in their face.
Well, right. I mean, that is indeed kind of what, that's kind of what Obama was saying last night. It's making something that is a default, it looked like a strategy in my view. I mean, the problem with it is essentially that there's a power struggle going on in the Middle East between Saudi Arabia and Iran. And we're allied with Saudi Arabia for very, very important reasons. It's because they've agreed that oil is denominated in dollars. And because they will agree with us about oil prices. In other words, if we feel oil prices are too high, we can call them up and tell them to put it down. They don't always do it. But we at least have a partner at the other end of the line. With Iran and Russia running the show, first of all, next place they're going to go is Saudi Arabia. And we're going to be talking about regime change there. And then you have a very bad situation for the United States where we potentially lose the dollar as a reserve currency.
Wow.
And we also lose control over the entire Middle East resources, which is, of course, important to the United States. So I think that's why we've been always hedging and a little bit – we never really wanted to alienate our allies in Saudi Arabia or Qatar or Turkey over this issue. At the same time, we're not fully in. And I think it's because the administration just doesn't understand the stakes.
Let me read a question from James. I'll put this to you, Samer. He says, do they see a possibility of two Syrias emerging, like in East and West Germany? Of course, it doesn't exist anymore, or like the Koreas. But the idea, I mean, you're sort of speaking a little bit to this, this notion of partition or perhaps a loose federation.
Yeah, I'm certainly not willing it, because I think that any partition means large-scale ethnic cleansing, because the Syria is not homogeneous, and many of the people who've been internally displaced are now, so you have areas, for example, of Hama and Homs, entire neighborhoods, or in Aleppo, that have been cleansed already. So the people that remain have kind of retreated into these sectarian enclaves. But in other areas, whether it's in Damascus or in the coastal areas, they've actually become more mixed because people have fled there. So anything, there's recently been some Syria Syria observers who've advocated for kind of three states or three something, you know, along the lines of Iraq. And I think that that's actually a recipe for more disaster, because if you have a Kurdish-only enclave, then you have Christians there, you have Muslim, you have Turkmen, you have everything. In the coastal areas, you have the same thing. You have a very heterogeneous population. And so the attempt to impose these kind of, you know, very strict borders where, you know, the Alawi run here and the Sunni run here and the Kurds run here would just make things, it would, you know, enhance the catastrophe. It would make it even worse. I can't even imagine what that would mean for the people who live there, because you would have even more cleansing than has existed now. Ideally, then in some sort of future, you would have decentralization, some form of decentralized authority where the Kurdish areas, the southern areas, the northern areas, Idlib, Aleppo, where there have been you know, where you have local councils, where you have courts, where you have things like this, that rather than being completely disbanded, that they get integrated into some sort of authority. And so that the state doesn't have to be this very strong, heavy state ruled out of Damascus, but can have some form of diffused authority. But it's unlikely that that will even happen, given the way that things are moving.
Let me get our final caller on. This is Reggie from Phillipsburg, New Jersey. And Reggie, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, thank you, Marty.
You're welcome.
I believe the United States government needs to be involved in most international crises. But any discussion of the Middle East, I think, has to involve how do we speak to the American families who've lost their loved ones' lives in it, fighting in Iraq, in a war that President Bush, on May 1st, 2003, said mission accomplished. Over 4,000 American dead, $1 trillion spent. So that's an important part of any discussion of the Middle East, is how many lives are Americans going to spend in solving that problem, and how much money is it going to cost?
Reggie, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And let me toss this to you, Mitchell, whether the ghost of Iraq and U.S. policy in Iraq really hangs over what the U.S. either does or doesn't do in Syria.
Right. Well, if you buy into the view I expressed a moment ago, that what we're looking at in the Middle East is a kind of a regional power conflict between, you know, Saudi Arabia and Iran, or, you know, U.S. and its allies, and say Russia and its allies, or Iran and its allies, then you have to regard the Iraq conflict as having been a mistake for the United States. We took a country that had been balancing Iraq and destroyed it, and it's now an ally of Iran. So and President Obama in the 60 Minutes episode last night said that the Iraq war was a mistake, and I think he's been clear on that. How do you talk to the families? I wouldn't know. I wouldn't know. I think it's a very, very difficult thing that this country got into a war that was a mistake for strategic reasons. Remember, at the time, we thought that, or some people in the administration thought that they were going to induce democratic regime change in Iraq. Now those ideas of democracy spreading throughout the Middle East, which were very current in Washington and frankly also in academia, I don't know if you've heard about that, Samer, but I was always quite skeptical of that. But certain people believed it and were idealistic and got us into something that We had no idea what the outcome was going to be.
Yeah. Well, much more to talk about. We do have to end our conversation. Mitchell Orenstein, thank you for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you, Margaret. It's great to be here.
Nice to have you here talking about such an important issue. A professor of Central and East European politics at the University of Pennsylvania, also a senior fellow at Foreign Policy Research Institute. Samar Abood, always a pleasure. Thanks
Thank you so much for
joining us
Amiga.
Once again on Radio Times, associate professor of international studies at Arcadia University, also author of a forthcoming book entitled Syria. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about the program, how to download podcasts of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. Appreciate those phone calls to Radio Times, and do stay with us. I'll be right back.